From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, another week of explosive violence in Iraq, and the handover of limited sovereignty is just 11 days away. Lately, this country, in its beleaguered circumstances, has looked like too much for anyone to handle. Consider just this week, at least 54 people killed and hundreds wounded in savage car bombings. Oil exports brought to a complete halt by pipeline sabotage. Senior Iraqi officials, including a high-level petroleum security chief, assassinated. More U.S. troops dead, now more than 800 dead in total. Polling results gathered by the Coalition Provisional Authority indicating 92% of Iraqis see coalition troops as occupiers and just 2% as liberators. President Bush remains optimistic, saying on Wednesday that a democratic, free Iraq is on the way, and glimmers of hope can be found. But the country Iraqis will be handed on June 30th is a country on a hard road. This hour, On Point, Iraq on the home stretch to handover. We'll hear tonight from reporters in Baghdad and just back from Iraq. But first, joining me from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Michael O'Hanlon.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
It's great to have you. So the clock is ticking. We're getting close to the time when Iraqis will get a great new degree of control. You've been following this by the numbers, Michael O'Hanlon. When you look out across all the indicators, give us a sense of the picture you see.
In broad terms, I divide things up into politics, security, and economics. I think the politics plan now, the June 30th transfer, is very good, although that's not as much the numbers game that you're asking me to play here. So let me now turn to the other two issues, security and economics, where unfortunately the news is much worse in both categories, I'm afraid. I'll leave security for last because we're all following that almost by the day.
Right.
Economics is an area where there has been progress over the months since the invasion of Iraq and the overthrow of Saddam. But what we've essentially done is recover the ground we lost in those first couple of months during and after the invasion. And we are now about back to the levels of quality of life, economic well-being that prevailed in Iraq in 2002 into early 2003, just before the war. In other words, we're about as good as things were under Saddam, and unfortunately, not much better.
And that, at the time, was characterized as not very good at all, after years of U.N. sanctions and Iraq being ostracized.
Exactly, as well as, of course, Iraq essentially having a Mideast version of a socialist economy, very poor economic rule, relying on its oil wealth to keep things above a certain basic level of decent quality of life, but still not a very healthy economy even before sanctions were applied. So if we're now attaining that level, we're not doing very well. There has continued to be gradual progress despite the shutdowns of electricity and pipelines and other things as a result of violence and the difficulties that we're having in getting dollars to flow into Iraq. So there is hope that the overall direction here will remain positive, but the progress has been quite gradual. And unfortunately, unemployment levels, perhaps the number one reason for concern of all, remain very high, somewhere between 30% and 50% based on the best data that one can muster.
So, Michael O'Hanlon, just on the economic front then, how does this stand compared to what the U.S. authorities hoped or predicted we would see in Iraq a year after invasion?
I don't recall that there were specific predictions of what level of GDP Iraq would attain by a given point after the invasion. Of course, there were a lot of predictions about how quickly we could draw down our forces and how quickly Iraq could resume oil exports and things like that. But for the most part, there was simply a presumption that things would go much better. And I think the best evidence I can muster for answering your question is to listen to the rhetoric of the Bush administration even today. For example, in May, President Bush, on his Saturday radio address, I think the first Saturday of May, said that conditions in Iraq today are a world different and a world better from what they were under Saddam. Well, of course, in some ways that's true, but in economic terms it really is not. And yet the administration continues to have that expectation, if not even that unrealistic view of current reality. So the administration thought that we would be in a demonstrably better Iraq by this point, by all metrics imaginable, and unfortunately we're not.
On that front, when the new Iraqi government takes its fullest degree of control after Paul Bremer gets on the plane and jets out, then just in economic terms, does it have a sustainable nation here?
Yes, it should be able to do all right over time, but it's not there yet. Certainly most countries in the world would love to have Iraq's oil exports, and the Iraqi people are not poorly educated, and they have a decent entrepreneurial spirit in many cases. And so I think that among Mideast countries, Iraq has a better fundamental economic circumstance than, let's say, Egypt or Jordan or Syria. It should be able to do better. I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert on the region. But when you look at those basic structural facts, they're fairly promising. On the other hand, we're not in very good shape now, and it's going to take perhaps another year or two to get back to a decent level of employment. I'm not so concerned about what Iraq's GDP is. I'm more concerned about the unemployment rate. And I'm stunned that a full year and a couple of months after the invasion, the unemployment rate remains as high as I mentioned earlier, somewhere between 30% and 50% by most estimates.
President Bush said on Wednesday, thousands of schools have reopened, electricity has been restored, markets are beginning to thrive, new businesses have opened, a stable new currency is in place. It sounds like a pretty bright picture.
Yeah, it's not bad, but you know, it's also, by most of those metrics, things are about where they were under Saddam. Iraq was not a horribly poor country. It was a country where people, for the most part, had food, and many of them, or most, had jobs, and schools and clinics and healthcare facilities were available. It was not a wealthy place, but it was a much preferable place to live in terms of economic conditions than most of the poorer non-oil producing countries in the Middle East. But if you take a couple of those specific metrics that you just mentioned, that the president's also mentioned, like electricity levels, they simply are not better than they were under Saddam. And in fact, the government's own data shows that typically they've lagged behind even late Saddam Hussein period electricity levels. They're still 5% to 10% below. There's a hope that this summer we can really get those numbers up as people want to turn on their air conditioners, but it's already plenty hot in Iraq, and unfortunately the electricity's not really there.
Okay, a year on then, back to Saddam levels of economic standing, not so great. Of course, if it's going to get better, as the president says it will, that depends on having enough security that the pipelines aren't being blown and the power generators aren't being blown. How do you assess the security front?
The security front is the quieter story, but it's not much better, and it's probably worse than the economic front. And when I say it's the quieter story, we're all painfully aware of American troop casualties and the firefights and so forth. But the real story here for many Iraqis is that their daily lives are not safe, whether they are part of an insurgency or not, and of course most are not, because crime is so rampant and because many of these suicide bombings that have characterized 2004 more than the post-Saddam period of 2003 have made them fearful of just walking out on the streets. But it really is crime as much as anything else, and we've simply not succeeded in instituting a basic level of confidence among Iraqis that they can walk the streets without getting mugged or otherwise assaulted. And this is a problem that really has led to a lot of the lack of confidence in the American-led stabilization effort.
The new Iraqi government was very fierce after the car bombings this week. The defense minister saying, we'll chase them from house to house, that's the insurgents. We will limit them, we will cut off their hands, and we will behead them. The interior ministry saying that the government would not hesitate to declare martial law if the bombings keep coming. But does this new government have the security forces trained and in place and loyal enough to do anything like handle this security threat if Iraqis and U.S. forces combined have not been able to?
No, I think you answered your own question. It's a pretty powerful case that if we are simply going to be doing less and the Iraqis, together with the United States and the coalition, cannot solve this problem, it's hard to see why the Iraqis by themselves or with a lesser degree of American help could solve it. We are in a position where there are a lot of Iraqis employed in security services, but most of them are not very well trained, and especially in the police and the army, the two core security institutions of any country and of Iraq as well someday, are in very poor shape. They are probably at roughly 10% levels of where they need to be in terms of trained personnel. So the martial law idea I actually find interesting, and drastic measures like that may be able to work. But again, you need the people on the streets in the security forces to enforce the laws. And I don't think the Iraqis could do that unless, of course, we do 75% of the work ourselves.
Hasn't Iraq effectively been under martial law? I mean, post an invasion, isn't that in essence how a country lives?
I don't think so, because what I think martial law means in this context is imposing very firm rules on when you can leave your house, especially after curfew hours.
I see.
That's my sense of what was being suggested. And to the extent that we're worried about a lot of criminal activity at night, a lot of improvised explosive devices being planted at night, martial law that keeps people off the streets at night, if enforceable, might actually begin to make some difference. And Iraqi citizens, although they've never been accustomed to this sort of thing in modern times, despite the terrible rule of Saddam Hussein, I don't believe that martial law was something that was experienced in the last decade, they might be willing to accept the trade-off of less personal liberty in the nighttime hours for a greater sense of security. So I think that idea has some interesting aspects to it that require further study and debate, but the forces may not be there to impose such a solution, even if it's in principle workable.
Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, said this week that Iraq was still too dangerous for his organization to come back. Of course, they suffered the big bombing last summer. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz saying in Iraq this week that Iraqi forces would need substantial help for some time. That feels like he's saying U.S. forces aren't really going anywhere, Michael O'Hanlon.
Well, I think the clear idea here is that we should be willing to stay for quite some time, but we cannot assume the Iraqis will want us, and we have to give them the choice to ask us to leave. And in fact, that's one of the things about the recent UN resolution passed last week that I like the best. This resolution makes it clear that we really are transferring sovereignty to the Iraqis, and one concrete manifestation of that is that they can tell us to go home anytime they want to. Presumably, this mission will end by the time the Iraqi constitution is validated late next year. There could be a follow-on mission, but this one will end. But the Iraqis could ask us to leave even sooner than that. It's an idea, by the way, that my colleague and boss, James Steinberg, and I advocated in the Washington Post in May. And at that time, it was viewed as tantamount to a cut-and-run strategy of promising that this mission would end at the end of 2005. But I think we need to be willing to tell the Iraqis, listen, we're going to conclude this phase of the effort in a finite time period, and then you have the choice of whether you want us to stay or not under a different mandate and different auspices. It's important to give them that sense of sovereignty, and I think doing so begins to give us a chance of reducing the anti-Americanism that's become the single most dangerous aspect of Iraqi politics today.
Some very tough numbers there. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I want to turn now to San Diego, where we're joined by Tony Perry, correspondent for the L.A. Times. He's been embedded with the 1st Marine Division for 3 months very recently, returned from Iraq just 10 days ago. He was with the U.S. Marines when they surrounded Fallujah. Tony Perry, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
Tony, you've been watching the trends in Iraq for months and months and months now, since essentially the beginning. How would you describe the trend line? Where are we headed as we approach the handover date?
Well, I think there are two trends sort of on a collision course, and one is the trend towards greater improvement, and the sort of numbers that Mr. O'Hanlon was talking about are getting better. They're not where they should be. They're not where the administration or the U.S. military thought they would be, but they are getting better. Things every day, there are schools being refurbished and clinics being buffed up and groups being organized. On the other hand, things are so insecure and so dangerous. That's the other trend, and it seems to be increasing, and the two are on collision. I remember talking to the commanding officer of the battalion I was with. He said, you know, you cannot eliminate want before you eliminate fear, and that's the problem. The fear is increasing, and we can't start eliminating the want without eliminating that fear.
So which is winning the race then, the security threat or the economic progress, and how do you think the handover will affect the kind of contest here?
Well, security comes first. You can't have a nation where people are afraid to walk down the street. You can't have a nation where people are afraid to associate with a certain group, in this case, the Westerners. So at this point, I think fear has the upper hand. And the question is, will the Iraqis be able to step forward and pick it up themselves? Will the Iraqi security force be able in the long run to do what has to be done, whether it's through martial law or, as they suggested, cutting off people's hands and incarcerating people by the droves? I don't know. But will they be able to do it? It's their country, and they have to, in the long run, step up and take responsibility. I think as we review what has happened in the last 12 months, I think disbanding the Iraqi army was one of those decisions that if we had it to do over again would not be followed through. We're essentially trying to reconstitute the army under a different name and under different ownership, but it's the same Iraqi army that we disbanded some months ago.
Tony Perry, we're going to come back and hear a lot more close-up detail from what you've seen very recently in Iraq. Glad you're with us. Tony Perry with the L.A. Times. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the home stretch to handover. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the home stretch to handover, June 30th. Now, just around the corner, we're joined tonight from San Diego by Tony Perry, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, recently returned from several months in Iraq. He has spent a lot of time in that country over the last year. We're joined now as well from Baghdad by Thanasi Kambanis, correspondent for the Boston Globe in Baghdad this evening, late this evening. Thanasi, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And from Baghdad by Bobby Ghosh, senior editor for Time magazine stationed in Iraq. This is his sixth stint in Iraq. Bobby Ghosh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So I want to hear the conversation between you three correspondents who have seen a lot and continue to see it every day. Thanasi, let me turn first to you. Give us a sense of Baghdad. Big bombings there this week and a very big one just yesterday. I think you were there not so long after the suicide bomb went off in the white SUV. What was that scene like?
It's the same horror almost daily. And yesterday with the 35 or 36 dead at that scene and the absolutely massive, catastrophic loss of life. I mean, you were seeing bits of bodies and people's papers, their passport photographs stuck to the barbed wire from the force of the blast. And what's happening now is that this happens literally almost every morning. We wake up to the sound of an explosion, and you can hear them miles away in the city. And it has a very deadening effect on people in Baghdad who had sort of grown to think one of these things might happen every month, not every day.
Bobby Ghosh, Tony Perry is describing a contest in Iraq that I'm sure you can see as well, sort of fear in a competition with development. And Tony's saying fear appears to have the lead right now with the instability, insecurity there. What's your sense of the trend line in Iraq as it comes into Iraqi hands? Is it on an upward trend, a neutral, downward? How would you describe it?
I would say that the trend is definitely downwards. The scenes that Thanasi just described so vividly are the scenes that are uppermost in the minds of most people. And Tony is absolutely right. Fear is the dominant emotion right now. And in fact, the approach of the handover, it isn't actually bringing any sense of relief, because there is concern that the people responsible for these bombings are sort of accelerating their operations leading up to the handover and probably directly afterwards. And people realize that to a substantial extent, the security of particularly Baghdad City will be handed over, at least in some areas, to newly trained Iraqi police and Iraqi civil defense forces who don't yet have the full confidence of the people.
Tony Perry, give us then some of the kinds of scenarios that you and other correspondents and Iraqis must discuss when you sit around at night looking forward. What are the options for how this is going to develop? President Bush describes it as kind of a tough road, but an inexorable road toward democracy and more freedom in the hands of an Iraqi government. Is that the scenario that appears most likely to you?
You know, the problem is the timeline. I think if time was not a political factor, and if there was time to get the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi army, the Fallujah Protective Brigade, the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, whatever name they're going by, if there was time to get them trained and equipped and up and ready, then you could have a greater share of optimism that they will be able to take over the responsibilities. But take Fallujah, for example. When the Americans, at the behest of the White House, when the U.S. Marines, two battalions of them, encircled Fallujah on the night of April 5th, they did so thinking that the Iraqi security forces would be right with them and that they would be able to, quote, put an Iraqi face on the mission. Didn't happen. Those Iraqis who were part of the security forces basically deserted. They took their uniforms and in some cases their American-purchased automobiles and fled. So it was all an American show, and that created a problem that was insolvable, because if the Marines had ultimately confronted the core of the insurgents after a month of fighting and had to go house to house, door to door, there would have been enormous casualties, both insurgents and the Marines, and there would have been civilian casualties. And since it was Marines versus Iraqis, it would have been politically explosive. There was no Iraqi face on the mission at all. And that's the problem, that the Iraqi security forces just haven't stepped up and taken over responsibility as they should.
And Thanasi Kambanis' colleague, Ann Bernard, has been back to Fallujah and written that now, where there is an Iraqi face on security there, it's not the legitimate sort of ordained security forces, but pretty much the same forces the U.S. was fighting when it was there. Where does this lead?
Well, let me sort of play a scene for you to imagine. This is in Baghdad now, not Fallujah.
Yes.
Iraqi police who catch carjackers have been videotaped beating them literally bloody. You see the carjacker, what we say the alleged carjacker, lying on the ground in a pool of blood being kicked while a crowd cheers them on. This is the kind of tough justice that a lot of Iraqis are clamoring for. Now, you know, we don't know in detail what's happening in Fallujah, but we do know that folks here that we talked to in Baghdad say, and these are men lying in their hospital beds yesterday, for example, after the bombing, saying, when we're in charge, if we see a suspected foreign fighter coming through a border checkpoint, we're not going to ask questions. We're not going to be hung up on the legalities that occupation troops tend to waste a lot of time with. If we think someone's a suspected terrorist, we're going to make sure they don't come in the country, or if they're here, we're going to make sure that they're not able to operate. And the implicit threat hanging over this is that we're going to go back to a kind of justice here that looks and smells a lot like Saddam's secret police.
But, Tanasi, presumably, at some level, if that brings security, as you say, Iraqis have been cheering it on the streets, and it might even be that Washington will applaud to the level that it lets the U.S. get its troops out, get its chestnuts out of this fire.
Well, and yesterday, after this bombing, when I was hanging around the hospital, I was surprised by the reaction people had to the idea of martial law or state of emergency. They were all pretty excited about it. And I sort of thought, well, you know, this is a country that went from Saddam to occupation. You'd think they'd be excited about some form of democracy. And in their mind, the idea of having the power to choose, they would like the power to choose martial law because they think that's what will work. And in the end, we might really get a brand of democracy that tastes a lot different than what U.S. policymakers thought they were selling.
Bobby Ghosh, here perhaps then is another tension, what Iraq ends up with politically in order to secure its just physical security. Sounds like very tough justice Tanasi Kambanis is describing here. On the other hand, the options may be this mayhem we've seen in the streets, or even at some point, there's been a lot of talk about Iraq splitting up. Is it going to take an iron fist to hold this country together and bring some kind of order to the streets?
Well, I can offer another scene that's slightly different from the one Tanasi described. A couple of days ago, when a huge car bomb went off, killing a few foreign contractors and a bunch of Iraqis as well, the crowd, after a little while, got very wild and started throwing things, including, I'm sorry to say, body parts at the fire and expressing anger at the Americans. And there were about 50-odd policemen at the scene, and they just stayed out of it. And when asked why, they said, well, we don't really want to get involved in a situation like this because we'll be, if we did, then people would accuse us of being pro-American. So, yeah, the police are fine or are willing to crack down on petty crime and things like carjacking. But when it comes to the militants or the terrorists, they are much, much more circumspect. And so I don't think there's going to be an iron fist, really, because the people with the ability to do that are themselves politically conflicted about what their countrymen would think of them.
Tony Perry, let's talk for a moment about the new interim government that's coming fully into power, such as it will be on the 30th or in the days that follow. What kind of reception have you seen it and heard it getting in Iraq? Does it look like it may be able to pull public opinion in behind it as legitimate, as a credible authority there?
We're remembering, of course, that I was in the Sunni Triangle. I was in Fallujah, Ramadi, the rural areas out there. And when you get out of Baghdad, Baghdad seems a world away. And I'm not sure that a change of government in Baghdad is going to impact outside of Baghdad a lot. I mean, this is a very broken up country once you have the strong man gone, and there's very little cohesion, and there's very little looking to Baghdad for leadership. The leadership has to come from the individual cities, and each city seems to have its own history and its own trend. That's why I'm not so sure that Fallujah is the model for anything except Fallujah. The Marines, when they cut the deal with the insurgents to turn over security needs to the Iraqis themselves, one reason they did that is they didn't want massive casualties, civilian casualties, who would become instant martyrs, and that there would be an instant cry throughout the region, remember Fallujah,
right.
And that small Fallujahs would pop up everywhere. And I think to that extent, they've been successful. While Fallujah is still run by a criminal element and life is very, very tough there, Fallujah has not become, as far as I can tell, a rallying cry that is influencing events in Najaf and Tikrit and other places. Those events are being influenced by their specific characters and history there. So I'm not sure that a change of regime in Baghdad really affects anything outside of the environs of Baghdad. This is a country that once the central authority has gone, once the heavy hand of Saddam has been gone, has really flown apart. And it's many countries. It's not one country.
There's an image, Baghdad as city-state. But Tanasi Kambanis, how about that? On the Tony Perry says each city kind of unto itself. And Fallujah is not a model. On the other hand, we saw just recently what looked like some kind of repeat where U.S. forces withdrew from Najaf and Kufa and again, kind of cut a deal to make that happen. Is that the pattern or not?
Yeah, I mean, when I said Fallujah is a model, I don't mean necessarily that, you know, literally how things unfold inside Fallujah once
sure.
the U.S. troops leave is how it'll unfold elsewhere. I do mean it as a model in that expectations are surrendered, U.S. leaves the place deciding it's not able to change it and is basically going to leave it to whatever the equivalent of the local warlord is. And then, it can choose if it wants to be a cooperative part of federal Iraq. And that is, as you pointed out, how things seem to be playing out in the stronghold of Maqdat al-Sadr. And in other places, it's going on just as quietly. Well, you know, whether you're looking at northern Iraq, where the Kurdish parties hold sway and may or may not choose to remain inside Iraq, or whether you're talking about a city like Amara, which few people hear about in the south, which is run by a warlord named Muhammad Awi, and he and his militia might choose to oppose the central government. These folks have a lot more local legitimacy, Tony points out, than any federal leader in the wings is going to have. And if they choose not to back the government, I don't see it having much weight.
And yet there will be a federal government, whatever its weight. What's the reception you've seen it getting, at least in Baghdad, Tanasi?
Well, it's the same reception in a lot of circles as the American troops got when they first got here. And what people tend to say is, I may not like the folks who are in it, but I'm going to wait and see if they deliver any results. If they don't, as one man put it, I don't care if the president is my brother. If things keep being the way they are, I'm not going to support his government. And I think they're going to get a short honeymoon, maybe a month after the handover of sovereignty. And if people don't see progress, they're going to turn against this government as bitterly as they did against the U.S. troops.
Bobby Ghosh, this same coalition poll that in May found that 55% of Iraqis said they would feel safer if U.S. troops left Iraq immediately, it also found that 60% in this poll were generally optimistic about their future, thinking that life would improve under the new interim governments. Do you sense this optimism somehow riding along at the same time that there's fear and uncertainty?
I have to say, I don't see a lot of that in the streets. If you talk to some people, you'll find that there's a sense of optimism about the long-term future. But in the short-term, leading up to elections, the rest of the year, I don't get any sense of optimism at all. Most people tell me that they're deeply concerned about the security situation. They worry that it'll get a lot worse before it begins to get better. They're concerned, and you quoted the poll saying that they'd feel safe if the Americans left. But I think as the deadline is beginning to approach, some people are reassessing that situation just a little bit. They're concerned that their own security forces may not now be ready to take over directly from the Americans. I think they're going to want to see a significant slowdown or a significant reduction in the terror attacks, particularly in the cities, before they feel that they can look towards their future in any constructive way.
Tony Perry, the Americans with the hottest front row seat on all this, of course, continue to be U.S. soldiers, 830-plus now dead. You spent a lot of time with them very recently. They have a lot at stake at how all of this unfolds individually. Can you give us a sense of the soldier's eye view of what's unfolding in Iraq, their level of optimism or otherwise about where this country's headed?
Of course, I was with the 1st Marine Division from Camp Pendleton that took over the Sunni Triangle from the 82nd Airborne Division of the Army. These are professionals. This is an all-volunteer force. They signed up to fight. Many of these young men signed up after 9/11. Many of these young men went last year to, as they say, Operation Iraqi Freedom 1. This is Operation Iraqi Freedom 2. And at the point I left, and morale is a volatile thing, it could be changing, but at the point I left, very high morale among these men, and a certain disappointment that they weren't ordered to make that final assault. But the Marines understand, the young ones and the officer corps, of course, understands that they're instruments of policy. And when policy shifts, the mission shifts. And the mission shifted right literally in mid-battle. But when I left, I thought the sense of morale and the sense of mission was extremely high.
So morale high, but at the same time, their futures and their postings depend on how well Iraq comes together, how well it operates after this handover.
I'm not sure that they're any more optimistic about Iraq's long-term problems and long-term future than anybody else. I mean, they're seeing it firsthand. They're seeing the illogic, or what they see as the illogic, of people blaming them for the car bombs, blaming them for the fact that the insurgents are quite willing to kill their countrymen, blaming them for the fact the insurgents are willing to hide among women and children and create the battle right there. And they find that to be an illogic, that they're there, the Americans are there, the Marines are there to help and to liberate. And they see an illogic in the fact that people aren't willing to help them, aren't willing to step forward. Now, there are reasons people aren't willing to step forward. It's dangerous. But that, I think, is hard for the Marines to understand.
Tanasi Kambanis, you've written that just with this last bombing, you witnessed what looked like perhaps a little changing of the tide, Iraqis blaming the violence not always on the Americans, but on insurgents among them, killing mainly Iraqis.
And it was an encouraging thing to hear, because all of us reporters have been at the site of a car bomb where people have sworn to us that it was American mortars or American rockets, like Tony was just mentioning. And I got a small sense, and I wouldn't want to overplay it, but that these folks I spoke to in the hospital were beginning to see an Iraq in which at least they would have a hand in the outcome of the security situation. And it was empowering to them to think that in a few weeks' time, and again, maybe it won't turn out this way, but they were thinking to themselves, in a few weeks' time, we're going to have our hand on the wheel, and we're going to be in the driver's seat, and maybe we can make things better.
Tanasi Kambanis with the Boston Globe, Bobby Ghosh with Time Magazine, Tony Perry with the LA Times. Please stand by. We've got just a few more minutes with you, and we value them. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the home stretch to handover, all the challenges, all the moods, all the obstacles and opportunities that face that country now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq on the home stretch to handover. Coming right up June 30th, joining us tonight from Baghdad, Bobby Ghosh, senior editor with Time Magazine, and Tanasi Kambanis, correspondent there for the Boston Globe. And with us tonight from San Diego, Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times, just back from a long stint embedded with U.S. Marines in Iraq in the Sunni Triangle. Bobby Ghosh, I wanted to ask you just to listen through to what President Bush was saying on Wednesday, and maybe you heard it. It was broadcast to troops, I know, in Iraq. But President Bush describing Iraq as a place where it's not happening all at once, but it's on the right road. He said markets are beginning to thrive, new businesses have opened, a stable new currency is in place, dozens of political parties are organizing, hundreds of courts of law are opening across the country, 170 newspapers are being published, thousands of schools have reopened. At that kind of level, Bobby, does this jibe with the Iraq that you see? Can you see that kind of, however slowly, that kind of blossoming of a civic life, a commercial life in Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not slowly at all. I remember being here before the war, being here directly after the war, and on this most recent trip, the difference is startling. There's been an enormous amount of progress. And if you sit down with Iraqi people and have a long conversation with them over several cups of tea, they will acknowledge that. But we have to keep in mind that for a father, the greatest concern is whether his kids are safe to go to school, or for for a mother, the greatest concern is whether her family will be safe when they go out of the house. It's those sort of day-to-day concerns that dominate people's emotions, and they acknowledge that things are a lot better, and they accept that if all goes well, things will get a lot better still. But the overwhelming number of people I've spoken to say that the security aspect is the one that's at the top of their minds.
Tanasi Kambanis, how about your view? You're there also in Baghdad. Can Iraqis, Baghdadis feel a kind of a slow or even rapid, as Bobby Ghosh says, progress toward better life, or is security just grimly overshadowing whatever happens there?
It doesn't overshadow everything. You drive down the main commercial street here in the center of Baghdad, Karada, and you will see hundreds and hundreds of air conditioners, refrigerators, you name the appliance, computers, satellite dishes, everything, literally blocking traffic, one lane of the road each way, blocked with merchandise that people are buying. So people have money, and they're spending it on things that make their lives better. And, you know, there are other studies, too. There's now as many cell phone users in Iraq as there are people with landlines. The number of internet signups among Iraqis has doubled, and these things are noticed and appreciated. I think where the disconnect between the U.S. occupation and the regular Iraqi comes in is when they're lectured by spokespeople for the occupation who say, you know, why don't you appreciate all the good things we're doing for you? And as Bobby was mentioning, it's really hard for a guy who, on his way to work, might get killed by a random passing car bomb to tell him to be happy about the fact that, you know, he can now buy a new refrigerator for his family. Undeniably, he's happy about the refrigerator, but I don't think that's his number one priority.
Tony Perry, cast your mind out. We've just got a couple of minutes left here. Look out a year, 18 months. No one has a crystal ball. We fully understand that. But what kind of future can you realistically, reasonably imagine for this country, Iraq?
I can imagine a better future, but a future that is still insecure and a future that it's in the hands of the Iraqis. They've got to step forward. Take the Sunni Triangle. We obsess over Fallujah because that's where the confrontation was. But just 30 kilometers away is Ramadi, a bigger city, actually, and a city more significant economically and historically to the whole region. And while there has been problems in Ramadi, there's been enormous progress. Schools, clinics, roads, lights, water, and the Marines from the 1st Marine Division picking up on what the Army has done are acting as ward healers. They're there every day helping the cousin of this one get a job and the nephew of that one get his car repaired and get their school back in good shape. It can happen, but it can't happen while things are blowing up on every street corner. Look at Ramadi. Fallujah is sort of the bad example. In many ways, Ramadi, while it has had problems and it still has a criminal element in it, is also an example of what can happen. And if you can get both the Marines, the Army involved, but also the Iraqis themselves involved.
Of course, in the meantime, just keeping abreast of what's going on there is sometimes challenging. Tanasi, Bobby, I know the job of being a reporter in Iraq has changed enormously over the last year. Tanasi, you were sharing a story about a Washington Post reporter traveling to Fallujah in a bulletproof car, and what happened?
Oh, this is Dan Williams, who actually wrote very powerfully about this in the Post. On his way out of town, he was driving a bulletproof car that was painted to look like an old beat-up Iraqi taxi, and someone he interviewed tipped off whether these guys were Mujahideen or gangsters. It's impossible to tell, but they were followed out of town and driving somewhere like 90 to 100 miles an hour trying to get out of Fallujah. They were shot with a machine gun so many times that the outer pane of the bulletproof glass was shattered, and it's really only by a miracle of luck that Dan and his driver survived, because their car lost control and the attackers left them for dead. And I actually saw that car parked outside of Abu Ghraib prison a couple of days later. The tires had been shot to shreds, the rear window missing, and they drove on the wheel rims 15 miles or so to safety. And that's the sort of image that we keep in our mind as reporters when deciding, you know, do we want to pop into Fallujah and see what the situation on the street there is like? And in recent weeks, we've more often than not answered no. You know, as reporters, we feel responsible for going to see these things. But as reporters who want to live to report another day, we often have to sacrifice stories we'd like to do.
Bobby Ghosh, just quickly, our time is coming to a close, but on that front, are we going to know what's happening in Iraq? Is it going to be secure enough for journalists to travel the country and send us back a picture.
Well, it's getting a little better than it was, say, a couple of months ago, but as Sanasi so graphically described it, it's still quite tricky. The good news is that Iraqi reporters are getting better at their job, and they can travel a little more freely than we can. And they're beginning to go to those places and give us reports now. In some instances, the Iraqi media is very deeply politicized. Many of the newspapers that you mentioned are owned by political parties. But there are also emerging a few good Iraqi publications that can be relied upon. And until things get a little safer, those will be our primary means of knowing what's going on in places like Fallujah, I think.
So here comes Iraqification and a handover, and all coming very quickly now. I want to thank all of you for being with us. It's just been great getting your reports. Bobby Ghosh with Time Magazine in Baghdad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Tanasi Kambanis in Baghdad with the Boston Globe. Good luck there, and thanks a lot, Tanasi. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Tony Perry in San Diego, back 10 days from Iraq. It's been great having you tonight. Thanks a lot for coming on. Good luck with all your work.
My pleasure.
Listeners, for all of On Point's coverage of the war in Iraq and to look at Michael O'Hanlon's Iraq Index, go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
All you do is remove the subsidy and you don't give a tax cut for $50 billion. But you pick up $50 billion, which is the amount of the subsidy. So you can put lipstick on a pig, but you can't call it a lady.
I have taken over 160 drug tests. I have taken tests before, during, and after the 2000 Olympics, and have never failed a test.
You know what I mean? We have the greatest fans in the NBA, and I love this team, and I love this city.
The Taguba report was released without the annexes and without my response or my attorney's response to those findings. I believe that General Taguba had a conclusion handed to him and went in search of an investigation to support it.
There was what we believe to be a suicide bomb that detonated in front of the Iraqi Army recruiting station, which is the site where that bomb detonated.
We have some planes that stay quiet and we'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
Both sides have an interest in handing Saddam Hussein over to the Iraqis. And the only matter is when is the appropriate time.
There have been reports of contact between Iraq and al-Qaeda also occurred after bin Laden returned to Afghanistan, but they do not appear to have resulted in a collaborative relationship. And so far, we have no credible evidence that Iraq and al-Qaeda cooperated on attacks against the United States.
The reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda, because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
I'm American. I worked on Apache helicopters.
Eyes have been on the clock all day, but now it appears that Paul Johnson has been killed by al-Qaeda operatives.
And there's a week the House passes a $150 billion corporate tax cut. New York's Charles Rangel objects. Marion Jones asserts her innocence again in the track and field steroid scandal that could keep her and other top American runners out of the Summer Games in Athens. The Detroit Pistons win the NBA title in a decisive win over the Los Angeles Lakers. It was the first championship for the Pistons since 1990. General Janice Karpinski, former American commander at Abu Ghraib prison, says she has been made a scapegoat by the U.S. military. Car bombings in Iraq this week kill at least 54 people and wound more than 100. The 9/11 Commission hearings wrap up with its last days of public hearings. The U.S. says it is not ready to hand Saddam Hussein over to the Iraqis just yet. The 9/11 Commission says there is no link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. President Bush refutes that claim and insists there was a link. And American Paul Johnson Jr. is beheaded today by his captors in Saudi Arabia. Jack Beatty, Shaky Times in Saudi Arabia.
Very grim. Really, that beheading was a form of economic warfare. It's going to drive Americans, if there are any left, out of the kingdom. And then it's going to be a question of whether the fifth column, which I've heard former CIA people describe in the oil fields, strikes at the oil.
Meaning Saudi employees or local employees who are handling the machinery of the world's energy supply.
That's right. And, you know, let's just roll the clock back. I mean, the administration said, you know, for too long we have just dealt with the regimes in the Middle East, just for our crass interests in oil. Now, by invading Iraq, we're going to bring democracy to that region and really give something substantive, not merely crass interests. Well, that crusade for democracy is endangering our crass interests, oil in Saudi Arabia. It is quite a turn of events.
Yeah, who knows what comes there next. What a scene. Paying for Wilsonianism. But of course, Jack, the idea was it could not go on with 9/11s popping up all over the place.
Well, that's right. And of course, that gets us back to 9/11 and the commission and their statement that al-Qaeda had nothing to do with Saddam. You know, now you have a situation where you have reality versus Bush-Cheney. A reality as documented by a bipartisan commission that has looked at the entire unclassified record. And that's a bad situation for a president to be in. I mean, Lyndon Johnson found himself in that situation in Vietnam when he was contradicted day after day by events on the ground. We called it a credibility gap then. And Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney face a yawning credibility gap now.
Do you think it's going to congeal as a credibility gap? They're still fighting that this week, Jack. President Bush says, I insist there was a link because there was a link. Can he hold that posture? Will it stick with the electorate?
I think it's all about the base, you know. I mean, I think it's all about people who are going to be with Bush no matter what. And he just wants to get every one of those to the polls. They're not trying to persuade anymore. They're not looking for that middle voter. It's the robe strategy. They want the 4 million evangelicals. And to them, that Bush is a man of faith is all they want to know. But, you know, an interesting finding in the Gallup poll last week, carries ahead by 20 points in the blue states, by 5 in the purple states. And Bush is only ahead by 4 points in the red states. And that suggests, suppose that holds up, you could actually have a repeat of the 2000 election where Kerry, racking up big majorities in the blue states, gets a whopping popular vote victory, but Bush wins it in the Electoral College, but with a much narrower base from the red states.
Oh boy,
Wouldn't that be something?
What a picture. I hope you're wrong on that, but you're saying, like Al Gore, only bigger numbers.
Only bigger numbers.
For a losing Democrat.
Yeah, bad for democracy.
Well, purple states, red states, blue states. Let's hope for some clarity out of this thing. Above all, Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.